Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Trump pushes back deadline on EU tariffs to July 9. The delay offers a block, a reprieve from the threatened 50% tariffs set to go into effect on June 1, by Gavin Bade. The U.S. will delay tariffs on the European Union until July 1, President Trump said on Sunday, giving a reprieve to his threat for 50% tariffs on the 27-nation bloc that were set to go into effect on June 1. Trump said in a social media post that he received a call from European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen requesting an extension. "It was my privilege to do so," he wrote. She said, "We will rapidly get together and see if we can work something out," Trump told a gaggle of reporters. The extension on the tariff deadline comes after Trump unexpectedly threatened duties of 50% on the EU on Friday morning. The move surprised European officials who thought they were making progress with his administration on talks to avert the 20% reciprocal tariffs Trump announced in April and then paused for 90 days. Trump, however, wrote on Truth Social on Friday that he felt talks with the EU were going nowhere and cited a litany of his trade irritants from the EU's value-added tax to fines and regulations on U.S. companies. The sides have also yet to agree on how to align their trade policies on China, though the EU has privately indicated that it is willing to work with the U.S. to combat Beijing's subsidies for key industries such as steel. Trump has long maligned the EU, which he says was formed to take advantage of the U.S., and decried the U.S.'s persistent trade deficit with the continent. The EU, meanwhile, has said it wouldn't negotiate over certain Trump demands, such as value-added taxes. And some European ministers have made it clear that they wouldn't accept a deal that keeps Trump's 10% baseline tariff in place, a concession the UK made in a pact signed early this month. Trump's statements on Sunday reverts the negotiations back to where they were before his Friday missive, giving the sides just over a month to come to an agreement. In a statement on X, von der Leyen said that EU is ready to advance talks swiftly and decisively, adding that to reach a good deal, we would need the time until July 9th. Asia markets mixed as unease persists on Trump tariff U-turns threats. U.S. futures were broadly higher while the greenback declined, by Kimberly Cao. Asian stock markets were mixed as unease about President Trump's policies shifts prevailed following the postponement of tariffs on the European Union and the threat of new duties on iPhones and other smartphones made overseas. Japan's Nikkei stock averages was 0.9% higher in late afternoon trading on Monday, while South Korea's KOSPI was up 1.25%. Australia's S&P/ASX 200 was 0.1% higher, with about an hour of trade remaining. Shares were mostly lower elsewhere, with Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index off by 1.2% and China's Shanghai Composite Index down 0.3%. While another U-turn on tariffs from the Trump camp put U.S. equity futures on a firmer footing and will buoy EU stocks futures too, broad participation will take time to build due to market holidays in the U.S. and U.K., says Chris Weston at Pepperstone. U.S. futures were broadly higher in the Asia session, with contracts tied to the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up around 1%. On Sunday, President Trump said the U.S. will delay tariffs on the EU until July 9, days after he threatened duties of 50% on the trading bloc. July 9th is also the deadline for the 90-day pause on most reciprocal tariffs on U.S. trading partners. Trump on Friday also floated slapping 25% duties on foreign-made smartphones, saying he expects Apple iPhones sold in the U.S. to be manufactured locally and not in India or any place else. China-listed Apple suppliers fell on Monday, with Luxshare's Precision Industries down 1.0%, Lens Technologies shedding 0.9%, and Gore-Tex declining 0.2%, pairing earlier losses. Trump's latest threat is generating uncertainty but is likely a negotiating tactic, Morningstar senior equity analyst William Kerwin said in a note. iPhone production in the U.S. isn't feasible in the medium term, and tariffs may be a way to get more U.S. investment from Apple, Kerwin said. Most Asian currencies rallied as the greenback declined. The Australian dollar appreciated by 0.5% against the U.S. dollar, while the South Korean won gained 0.1% and the Singapore dollar strengthened 0.3%. The euro was last 0.4% higher at 1.1410 against the dollar. Prices of gold ticked down 0.3% to 3,346.48 a troy ounce, while front month WTI crude oil futures and front month Brent crude oil futures added 0.4% each. Any more tariff news this week could inject more volatility into currency markets and pull the U.S. dollar further down, said Samra Hammond, international economist and currency strategist at Commonwealth Bank of Australia. Trump calls Putin crazy after massive Russian aerial assaults on Ukraine. At least 12 killed and dozens injured as strikes across the country hit residential buildings, Ukrainian officials say, by James Marson and Evgenia Siorkia. President Trump issued a strong rebuke of Russian President Vladimir Putin after Moscow stepped up missile and drone assaults on the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv and other regions in attacks that killed at least 12 people. Russia struck with a total of 367 drones and missiles, one of the largest single-night raids of the war, according to the Ukrainian Air Force, in a second consecutive day of pounding attacks that sent civilians running for shelters in the middle of the night. Officials said that children were among those killed, and that a further 60 were injured and more than 80 residential buildings damaged across the country, even as more than 300 of the missiles and drones were shot down. President Volodymyr Zelensky called for more economic sanctions against Russia to force it to stop its invasion, which Russian President Vladimir Putin has refused to do despite Trump's entreaties. Russia is dragging out this war and is continuing to kill on a daily basis, he said on social media. It can't be ignored. The silence of America, the silence of others in the world, only encourages Putin. Trump late Sunday criticized Putin, saying in a social media post, he has gone absolutely crazy. He is needlessly killing a lot of people, and I'm not just talking about soldiers. Missiles and drones are being shot into cities in Ukraine for no reason whatsoever. Trump was also critical of Zelensky, saying in the same post that Zelensky is doing his country no favors by talking the way he does. The Russian Defense Ministry said its strikes had targeted Ukrainian military production facilities. The ministry said it had downed 110 Ukrainian attack drones in regions across the west of Russia, including Moscow. Ukrainian officials said that their large-scale drone attacks on Russian targets in recent days have damaged several Russian military industrial facilities, including a factory that makes parts for ballistic missiles. The increased ferocity of Russia's assaults comes days after Trump demurred on threats to sanction Russia further if it didn't sign an immediate 30-day ceasefire. In a two-hour call with Trump last week, Putin refused a truce with Kyiv consented to in March. Trump has publicly insisted that Putin wants peace, but in a call with European leaders this week, conceded that Putin isn't ready for peace, the Wall Street Journal reported, because he believes he is winning. Zelensky said only pressure on the Kremlin would yield results. Resolve is important right now. The resolve of the United States, the resolve of European countries, of all those in the world that want peace, Zelensky said Sunday. The world knows all the weak points of the Russian economy. It is possible to stop the war, but only thanks to the necessary pressure on Russia. Ukraine countered the aerial assault with a combination of missile defense, Western-provided F-16 jet fighters, and small drones used to intercept Russian strike drones, an Air Force spokesman said. Trump last week said that Ukraine and Russia should continue negotiations over a peace deal among themselves, talks that so far have yielded only one tangible result, a three-day exchange of around 1,000 prisoners from each side that concluded Sunday. Russia has confounded Trump's efforts to end the war, which it launched in February 2022, insisting that its original war goals of a neutered Ukraine under firm Russian influence be met even as its army struggles to advance in its neighbors east. U.S. aims to keep Chinese Navy guessing with new missile system. As China dominates swaths of the Pacific, the U.S. is looking for ways to push back. The Nemesis is a key part of that. By Gabrielle Steinhauser. The Air Force C-130 transport plane dipped down on the sun-baked airfield of this remote island in the northern Philippines, delivering a weapon system designed to give the U.S. an edge in the intensifying superpower standoff in the Pacific. The Navy Marine Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, or Nemesis, is an anti-ship missile launcher mounted on a remote-controlled truck. The dumbbell-shaped islet, where it landed, lies just 120 miles south of Taiwan. For the Marines, the Nemesis's flight to Bataan was a key test in a high-stakes retooling aimed at readying the military's rapid response force for a war with China in some of the world's most strategic but increasingly tense waterways. The prospect of an armed conflict with China, whether over Taiwan, the self-governed democracy Beijing claims as its own, or the contested shipping lanes of the South China Sea, has the U.S. playing catch-up. While the American forces were bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, China built up the world's biggest navy and a formidable arsenal of missiles aimed at making swaths of the Pacific off-limits to its adversaries. The Nemesis, pronounced Nemesis, was designed to erode that lead. It takes advantage of natural choke points like Bataan to raise the cost of access for Chinese warships. Initially built to be launched from ships, the Norway-made naval strike missiles the Nemesis fires can sink vessels some 115 miles away, skimming the water and adjusting their trajectory to follow and hit a moving target. With the Nemesis, Marines can now shoot these high-precision missiles from land, including from remote, mountainous islands like Bataan, where launchers are far easier to conceal than on the open water. The main vehicle carrying the missiles is unmanned. Its operators work from a distance, based in two support vehicles that place them outside the line of fire of anyone trying to take out the launchers. The Nemesis's mere presence on strategic islands in the Pacific complicates decision-making for adversaries, who have to weigh the threat it poses for any vessel that may find itself within striking distance, said Colonel John Lehane, the commander of the Hawaii-based Marine Regiment that deployed the system to Bataan late last month as part of an annual exercise. Once you put it on the ground, it is there. It can move around. It is hard to find, Lehane said. The Nemesis's anti-ship capabilities give it an edge over other land-based missile systems, such as the M142 High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, or HIMARS, which helped transform battlefield in Ukraine, but has struggled to hit moving targets at sea, Lehane said. Rommel Ong, a former vice commander of the Philippines Navy and now a senior research fellow at the Ateneo School of Government in Manila, likened the Nemesis's presence on islands in the Western Pacific Islands to a shell game. You keep the other side guessing, and that creates the uncertainty, and in a way, that creates the deterrent effect, he said. Lehane's 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment was the first Marine unit to take delivery of the new system late last year. The Nemesis is a centerpiece of a broader overhaul of the Marines aimed at making the force more agile, able to swoop into action even after a conflict has already erupted. The Philippines, America's oldest treaty ally in Asia, is a key part of that new push. The government of President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has given the U.S. military access to more bases on which it can build facilities, pre-position equipment, and refuel and maintain aircraft and vessels. Since the U.S. has no permanent troops based in the Philippines, Washington would have to airlift fighters and weapons to small, hard-to-access islands under the threat of enemy fire. Extensive drills mean that some U.S. troops now rotate through Philippine bases for much of the year. That not only improves coordination with the armed forces of the Philippines, but also allows Marines and Air Force pilots to get more familiar with the topography of the Pacific Theater. On practice flights and reconnaissance missions, they scope out mountains and other features that could serve as cover. "We get really low and hide," said Captain Benjamin Dorsey of the 39th Airlift Squadron, which moved to the Nemesis to Bataan. Lehane said the successful deployment of the Nemesis should signal to potential adversaries that the Marines' island fighters are ready for combat. "A lot of folks are still perceiving our unit as experimental, and it's absolutely not experimental," he said. "The most important thing is to get folks accustomed to the fact that where you see the 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment, you should expect that there are Nemesis with us." Should everyone be taking Ozempic? Doctors say more people could benefit. Anti-obesity drugs are showing promise for an ever-expanding list of diseases, by Peter Loftus. That is the kind of half-joking question that doctors kick around when a new class of drugs begins to help a big chunk of the population. Cardiologists used to quip about spiking water systems with cholesterol-reducing statins because of their ability to prevent heart attacks. Now, Ozempic and others in the GLP-1 category of drugs are approaching that critical mass. They are showing promise for an ever-expanding list of diseases beyond today's most common uses of weight loss and treating diabetes, heart, kidney, and liver diseases, sleep apnea, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, alcohol addiction, even aging. Some of these are potential benefits that need further study. It is getting to the point of wondering what GLP agonists aren't good for, pharmaceutical researcher and blogger Derek Lau wrote in the academic journal Science last year. If this trajectory continues, doctors say millions more people would benefit from them, maybe even 1/3 to a majority of adults. But they also caution about use of the drugs in people who don't medically fit the bill because it could cause malnourishment. Doctors would have to figure out ways to guard against excessive weight loss in people who aren't overweight, perhaps putting them on special diets, said Dr. Scott Isaacs, an endocrinologist in Atlanta. The drugs, which also include Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Zepbound, mimic naturally occurring gut hormones such as GLP-1. The medicines promote production of insulin, which helps control blood sugar levels in people with type 2 diabetes. They suppress appetite and make people feel full faster when eating, helping overweight people lose many pounds. In diabetes and obesity alone, the eligible patient population is huge. More than 100 million American adults, or 40%, have obesity. About 38 million have diabetes. Many of the proven and potential benefits of the drugs cascade from their effect on obesity. Losing weight relieves sleep apnea. It takes pressure off the joints, helping with arthritis. If you treat obesity, all the complications of obesity that we spend a lot of our time treating in medicine should get better, said Dr. Louis Aron, director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Center at Weill Cornell Medicine. But it also seems likely that some benefits are independent of weight loss, possibly because of anti-inflammatory effects of the drugs. The science is evolving very quickly in understanding how these medications also affect so many organs and inflammation, said Dr. Robert Kushner, an obesity treatment specialist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Doctor said GLP-1 type drugs may help with psoriatic arthritis, an autoimmune condition that causes joint pain and skin rashes because of weight loss, but also for their potential to reduce inflammation. Susan Abernathy of North Cove, Washington, started taking Eli Lilly's diabetes drug Mounjaro in 2023 to help treat her psoriatic arthritis after older treatments weren't working as well. The 58-year-old chief operating officer of a nonprofit credits Mounjaro with helping her lose weight and relieving her joint pain. She takes it along with Taltz, which is approved to treat psoriatic arthritis. Her insurance pays for the combination in part because she also has type 2 diabetes. After about 4 years of not being able to run and do things, I've been able to do a couple of 5Ks again, she said. I can walk longer on the beach than before. Lilly is studying the combination of Taltz and Mounjaro's main ingredient to treat psoriatic arthritis in a phase 3 study with the hopes of seeking regulatory approval of the use if the study is successful. Doctors are also seeing success in treating people with certain liver diseases. Isaacs also prescribes GLP-1s for people with a fatty liver condition called metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, or MASH, which is estimated to afflict about 15 million Americans. A study published in New England Journal of Medicine in April found that semaglutide, the main ingredient of Ozempic and Wegovy, improved the condition in patients. Another area being considered, Alzheimer's disease. Researchers believe GLP-1s may have neuroprotective effects, slowing loss of brain volume. A small study in the UK last year found that Novo Nordisk GLP-1 liraglutide slowed cognitive decline versus a placebo. Novo is conducting a phase 3 trial of semaglutide in patients with early Alzheimer's. About 137 million American adults, more than half of the adult population, are eligible for treatment with the GLP-1 drug semaglutide based on having type 2 diabetes, meeting the threshold for excess body weight, or having established cardiovascular disease and excess weight, researchers estimated in a paper published in JAMA Cardiology last year. In comparison, about 82 million U.S. adults are eligible for statins, but only a fraction of those eligible are currently taking a GLP-1 drug, about 8.3 million in the U.S. this year, T.D. Cohen estimated. The percentage of the eligible population taking a GLP-1 outside the U.S. is even smaller. Global uptake of weight loss drugs is minuscule relative to the addressable market, T.D. Cohen analysts wrote in a research note. Still, some people clearly shouldn't take the drugs. I do believe that a large percentage of the population, but not everyone, is going to be able to get some benefit, Aron said. People with a history of a type of thyroid cancer or with certain head and neck tumors shouldn't take them because earlier studies show that the drugs cause those type of tumors in rats. Some doctors are reluctant to prescribe them to people with a history of pancreatitis because some patients taking the drugs have developed severe cases of that condition, and some doctors shy away from prescribing them for cosmetic weight loss when no other medical conditions are present. Use of the drugs surely will grow. Morgan Stanley analysts estimate that by 2035, the number of Americans using GLP-1 for obesity alone will rise to about 29 million. But even that would only represent 20% of the eligible obesity population. That is because anti-obesity drugs are expensive. List prices are over $1,000 a month. Many insurance plans don't cover them, and even manufacturer discounted prices are still several hundred dollars a month. Tolerability and manufacturing capacity of the drugs might also be issues. Some patients stop taking the drugs because they suffer unpleasant gastrointestinal side effects. And two main manufacturers, Lilly and Novo, only recently resolved drug shortages by increasing production, but they are still far from reaching enough capacity to supply significantly bigger percentages of both current and future eligible populations. More studies and better drugs could help boost the treatment rate. Companies are developing newer GLP-1s that could deliver greater weight loss and pill versions that might be more appealing to patients who don't like getting shots. Buying 100% made in America is really, really hard. These people are trying. Crawling inside fridges and scouring Reddit, these diehard shoppers look for truly American products, but make some exceptions. By Natasha Khan and Rachel Louise Ensign. Diana Huff has been on a decades-long quest to buy only made-in-America goods. It has worked for items such as sheets, socks, and sofas, but for other things such as her phone, glasses, and weed whacker, it is next to impossible. She recalls crawling inside her fridge in search of a manufacturer's label, only to see the tiny words, "Made in Mexico," and returning a bathroom scale because despite assurances that the company made products in its U.S. facilities, it didn't. "It's been a real journey that's come with frustrations and misadventures," said Huff, a 62-year-old New Hampshire resident who wants to support American manufacturing workers with her spending. "Many Americans say they want to buy domestic products, but global supply chains built over decades of outsourcing have made it challenging. No matter how committed these shoppers are, some products just aren't made in USA. Almost half of new passenger vehicles sold in the U.S. in 2024 were assembled outside the country, according to data from S&P Global Mobility. And nearly all of the smartphones sold in the U.S. are made overseas. Companies often try to tout their American-made bona fides, even if they make only a small share of their goods in the U.S. Politicians from different parties have embraced the cause, too. Independent presidential candidate Ross Perot railed against losing U.S. manufacturing jobs overseas. Democratic President Barack Obama tried to promote domestic manufacturing. President Trump's tariff strategy aims to bring manufacturing back to towns and cities across the country. Trump on Friday threatened a 50% tariff on imported goods from the European Union and new duties on iPhones made overseas. The U.S. imports from the EU cars, apparel, and alcohol products, among other things. "Made in America is not just a label slapped on a product. It's a symbol of American greatness," said White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers. "It is a label the whole world will get used to seeing when we become a global manufacturing powerhouse once again." Manufacturers moved production overseas, where labor costs were much lower, spurred in part by free trade agreements. Many people who are interested in buying American-made goods don't or can't, because products made in the U.S. are often more expensive. In May, Morning Consult survey of about 1,000 U.S. adults, more than half said they intentionally bought domestically produced goods at least sometimes, but only 11% of those were willing to pay more for U.S. goods could stomach a price increase greater than 15%. Older Americans and Republicans were more likely to buy domestic. Matt Brainerd, a Republican political consultant who has been trying to buy American for the past 5 years, said the switch has saved him money because his items last longer. The 47-year-old swapped his Hugo Boss boxer briefs, 5 for $69, for ones from Hard Hat Apparel, 5 for $89.99, and began buying socks from Fitz Socks, $13.99 or more per pair, and the Made in America sock company starting at $14.99 for 2 pair. Brainerd, who lives in Northern Virginia, works with political candidates and runs an organization whose work includes advocating for the defendants involved in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. After deciding to buy American, he gave away his Zynga shirts and neckties and bought shirts from White Dress Shirts and ties from R. Hanhauser. He still hasn't found a domestically produced suit, so he sticks with one that he bought in a Cleveland strip mall nearly a decade ago. There are other products that are harder to find made in America by a U.S. company. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org, then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now back to our article. He drives a car made in the U.S. by BMW, and he has a Samsung electronic smartphone in his pocket. It isn't always easy, Brainerd said. When I walk through a shopping mall, there's really nothing for me there. He says he found a company that made some of its nonstick pans in the U.S., but it didn't allow him to buy a set of pans that were all U.S. made. When he was looking for a new power drill, he read through a Reddit thread where a U.S. factory worker who made the product discussed where the parts inside the drill came from. He couldn't find American-made razor blades for shaving, so he buys from Procter & Gamble-owned Gillette, which has some U.S. facilities. Making exceptions is a part of life for the diehards. Ann Collins, 75, took up buying domestic as a hobby after she retired from her job as a graphic designer in 2016. She started the Facebook group, Having Fun Buying Not Made in China. The group doubled in size to about 2,000 members this year with tariffs in the news. Collins, who lives in Laurel, Maryland, has helped group members find domestically produced mops, foil pans, and artificial flowers. But when she set out to make her sister a duck-themed Easter basket this year, the only American items she could find were a greeting card and a packet of Peeps. She filled the basket with knickknacks from big retailers anyway. I wasn't going to give up the fun of it just because some things were made in China, she said. In a Reddit forum for people interested in buying American-made products, a commenter asked, "Is a completely made in USA life possible?" One person responded that it would require living like Ted Kaczynski, the infamous recluse known as the Unabomber, who lived a primitive lifestyle in a remote cabin. Lynn Sterling, 72, turns over products to see where they are made, a practice inspired by her parents, who believed any spending should benefit the local community. She also wants the manufacturers to be U.S. companies. She buys U.S.-made New Balance sneakers. She drinks Folgers coffee, which is owned by U.S.-based J.M. Smuckers. Her big concession is a blue mascara made by L'Oreal, which is based in France. It's the one I give myself permission for, Sterling said. L'Oreal said the L'Oreal Voluminous Mascara in Cobalt that Sterling uses is made in its plant in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sterling said she drinks Crystal Geyser bottled water, which is sourced from seven springs across the U.S. Crystal Geyser is owned by Tokyo-based Otsuka Holdings, a fact that isn't disclosed on the label. When Sterling was told by a Wall Street Journal reporter about the ownership structure, she said, "Oh no, bummer." Investors pile into ETFs at record pace despite market turmoil. U.S. exchange-traded funds have collected some $437 billion in new assets so far this year, by Jack Pitcher. This year's volatile trade war-obsessed market didn't shake American investors' fondness for exchange-traded funds. In fact, it only made them love them more. Investors have plowed a record $437 billion into U.S. ETFs so far this year, unfazed by the wildest markets since COVID. And if inflows maintain the current pace, historically they accelerate in the summer and fall months, it will mark the second straight record year for U.S. ETF flows. That is happening in part because of the relentless flow of money out of mutual funds and into ETFs, which tend to offer lower fees and certain tax advantages that their older cousins can't match. But the decade-long trend doesn't fully explain this year's surge. Indeed, when U.S. markets turned choppy, many began to double down on their bets on U.S. assets. And now more than ever, they place those wagers by buying ETFs. Investors are seeing sell-offs as buying opportunities, said Todd Rosenbluth, head of research at data provider VettaFi. The hundreds of billions of dollars that investors poured into ETFs found their way into every major fund category, stock funds and bond funds, funds that track popular indices, continue to sell well, but so have those that managed by professional stock and bond pickers, a relatively new corner of the ETF market that has gained momentum. No one fund benefited more from the surge than the ETF industry's new champ, Vanguard Group's S&P 500 ETF. The ultra-cheap index fund has soaked up a stunning $65 billion in net inflows this year, along the way becoming the world's biggest ETF by assets. Known by ticker symbol VOO, the fund more than doubled the previous annual ETF inflow record when it took in $116 billion last year. Now it is on pace to reset that mark again by October. VOO's rise illustrates how investors more broadly turned to ETFs this year. When stock market volatility soared to a five-year high in April, Vanguard's S&P 500 fund reported its highest monthly inflows ever. Many investors had built up large cash holdings by then and had been waiting for the right moment to shift money back into stock, according to Greg Davis, President and Chief Investment Officer of Vanguard. During that period of tumult in early April, we saw a 5-to-1 sell ratio, Davis said. Investors have a tremendous amount of cash sitting on the sidelines, and they know that if things are on sale, it is time to put money to work. Swelling ETF assets have been a windfall for Vanguard and BlackRock, the two largest U.S. fund managers. BlackRock Chief Executive Larry Fink has talked repeatedly about the opportunity for his firm to capitalize on a reallocation from cash to stock and bond funds. In the United States, there's $11 trillion sitting in money market funds, Fink said at the Saudi U.S. Investment Forum in Riyadh earlier this month. When there is uncertainty, you're going to keep more money in cash, and that is what we witnessed. Several years after the Federal Reserve began lifting interest rates to combat inflation, the allure of cash is still strong for many investors. The second most popular ETF this year has been a BlackRock 0-to-3-month Treasury bond fund, which has almost $17 billion in inflows. The cash-like fund has a 12-month trailing yield of 4.7%. A similar offering from State Street is also in the top 10 of the flows leaderboard. We are seeing some defensiveness on the fixed income side, said VettaFi's Rosenbluth. With several short-term treasury products in the top 10, that's a sign investors are happy being paid to wait. Still, equity funds have taken in a majority of this year's flows. Joining VOO in the top 10 are State Street's S&P 500 fund, Vanguard's total stock market and equity growth funds, and two NASDAQ 100 funds from Invesco, an actively managed equity firm from J.P. Morgan that aims to reduce volatility and produce above-average dividend income through an options strategy, also cracked the top 10, part of a broader class of active funds that some analysts have dubbed boomer candy, thanks to their popularity with retirees. The J.P. Morgan fund is building on a breakout 2024. Actively managed funds continue to capture an outsized share of new assets. According to Track Insight, 30% of this year's ETF flows have gone to active funds, even though they make up less than 10% of the industry's total assets. Longtime mutual fund giant Fidelity has been focusing on active ETF launches in recent years, and interest continues to grow, said Greg Feedman, Fidelity's head of ETF management and strategy. For the last 12 to 24 months, we've been seeing a very nice level of inflows, with most of it in the active side, Friedman said. That has held up even during extreme volatility. For years, investors have been swapping their mutual funds for tax benefits and liquidity offered by ETFs, boosting inflows. That trend could soon accelerate even further. Dozens of fund managers have filed applications with the Securities and Exchange Commission to offer new ETF share classes of existing mutual funds, which would allow them to offer popular strategies in the ETF wrapper without starting from scratch. SEC Commissioner Mark Udaya said earlier this year he has told the agency staff to give priority to the issue, and many in the industry are expecting approval as soon as this year. A Supreme Court showdown on Trump's agency firing opinion. The justices signal that Humphrey's executor is dead, except perhaps for the Federal Reserve, by the editorial board. The Supreme Court on Thursday let President Trump fire two members of so-called independent agencies without ruling the merits of their legal challenges. But even the liberal dissent seems resigned to the court's Humphrey's Executor 1935 precedent as a dead letter. Mr. Trump has been testing the limits of executive power with the goal of teeing up cases for the Supreme Court to consider long-standing precedents. He succeeded with his removal of National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, member Gwynne Wilcox and Merit Systems Protection Board, MSPB, member Kathy Harris, who challenged their dismissal under Humphrey's executor. 90 years ago, the court held that a president could not remove members of the Federal Trade Commission except for one for cause, e.g. neglect of office or malfeasance, because the agency exercised quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial rather than executive power. Such constitutional logic was dubious at the time, and the justices have cabined Humphreys in recent decisions. The High Court struck down removal protections for the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Celia Law, 2020. Chief Justice John Roberts' majority opinion stressed that Humphreys represents the outermost constitutional limits of permissible congressional restriction on the president's removal power. A split D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals panel allowed Mr. Trump to remove Ms. Wilcox and Ms. Harris on grounds that Humphreys is an exception to presidential removal, not the rule. Humphreys applies only to an agency materially indistinguishable from the 1935 FTC, as Humphreys understood the 1935 FTC, Judge Justin Walker wrote in a concurring opinion. With outright rejecting the Humphreys, the panel said Mr. Trump was likely to prevail because the NLRB and MSPB exercise executive power. The NLRB promulgates rules, issues cease and desist orders, and can seek injunctions in federal court. Nearly all so-called independent agencies exercise some executive power. A majority of the justices agreed, judging by Thursday's unsigned order, Trump v. Wilcox. Because the Constitution vests the executive power in the president, the court held, he may remove without cause executive officers who exercise the power on his behalf, subject to narrow exceptions recognized by our precedents. This order reflects our judgment that the government is likely to show that both the NLRB and MSPB exercise considerable executive power. Without touching Humphreys, the justices signaled where they are likely to come out if the court takes up the case after the D.C. Circuit holds full briefings. The court's three liberals seem to know what's coming. The majority has foretold a massive change in the law, reducing Humphreys to nothing and depriving members of the NLRB, MSPB, and many other independent agencies of tenure protections, Justice Elena Kagan writes in a dissent, joined by Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Justice Kagan has a point that the majority issued non-binding dicta by appending a side note that its order doesn't necessarily implicate removal protections for members of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors or the Federal Open Market Committee, because the central bank is a uniquely structured quasi-private entity with a distinct historical tradition. Maybe so, but that question deserves a full briefing and elaboration as Wilcox proceeds on the merits. There are good arguments on both sides of the Fed question. Meanwhile, progressives are protesting that the court's order on Thursday will gut independent agencies. Au contraire, the justices are merely ending the unconstitutional charade that such agencies are truly independent of the president. Opinion. Is Trump trying to destroy Harvard? The order against foreign students turns away the world's brightest. The Trump administration has frozen billions in federal grants to Harvard University, threatened its tax-exempt status, and sought to dictate its curriculum and hiring. Now the government seems bent on destroying the school for the offense of fighting back. And for what purpose? That's how we read the Department of Homeland Security's move Thursday to bar foreign students from attending the world-renowned institution. That's 6,800 students, or a quarter of Harvard's student body, whose futures are suddenly in disarray. It's also a short-sighted attack on one of America's great competitive strengths, its ability to attract the world's best and brightest. The latest assault began when DHS demanded that Harvard turn over sundry records on its foreign students, including whether any had participated in illegal activity or left the university owing to dangerous or violent activity or deprivation of rights. Some of its record requests are reasonable, but some overreached by requiring private student information. DHS also gave Harvard all of 2 weeks to respond. If it failed to do so, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem said she would automatically withdraw the school's certification in the Student and Exchange Visitor Program. The withdrawal will not be subject to appeal. The SEVP program lets non-citizens enroll at universities on student visas. DHS can bar universities from the program if they fail to comply with record-keeping, retention, reporting, and other requirements on foreign students. Harvard says it responded with information required by law within 2 weeks and handed over more records on May 14th. Ms. Noem deemed Harvard's response unsatisfactory and kicked the school from the program. This means foreign students will have to leave the country in short order or find another U.S. college that will take them. Most of Harvard's foreign students are enrolled in graduate programs. Many assist with scientific research and teaching undergraduate courses. Driving them out of Harvard will disrupt research projects and might cause some professors in the sciences to leave for other universities. This seems to be the goal of freezing Harvard's research grants. Harvard sued on Friday, and a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order against the student ban. The university rightly says the administration's actions are clear retaliation for Harvard exercising its First Amendment's rights to reject the government's demands to control Harvard's governance, curriculum, and the ideology of its faculty and students. The university seems likely to prevail on the law, but until courts settle the merits, thousands of students who have done nothing wrong will be in legal limbo. Some of them no doubt oppose the anti-Israel protests and may even hail from Israel. Why punish them? The Trump team's tactics against Harvard recall how the Obama administration cut off student aid to for-profit Corinthian colleges on the pretext of its alleged dilatory response to sweeping record demands. Thousands of students' education were disrupted so the Obama team could wave a political scalp. This will be terribly damaging to America's ability to attract talented young people who bring their enterprise and intellectual capital to the U.S. Non-citizens accounted for more than a half of doctoral degrees in AI-related fields in 2022. Many have gone to work at U.S. companies like NVIDIA or started their own. The National Foundation for American Policy finds that immigrants have founded or co-founded nearly two-thirds, 65% or 48 of 43 of the top AI companies in the United States, and 70% of full-time graduate students in fields related to artificial intelligence are international students. Immigrants have also started more than half of America's privately held startups valued at $1 billion or more. Even if it's modified, Ms. Noem's order will echo around the world as a signal that the U.S. is no longer open to educate the world's brightest young people. Foreign students will get the message and take their talents elsewhere. China's Politburo must be laughing at their good luck that their main adversary is hamstringing itself, first with tariffs that make its firms less competitive, and now with an assault on immigrant talent. Like most of U.S. higher education, Harvard needed a jolt to return to its mission of educating open minds. But that requires reform. The Trump administration seems to think it needs to destroy Harvard to save it. That is the opposite of making America great. Weak dollar is bad news for a troubled U.S. Treasury market. The U.S. dollar continues to weaken despite rising rates, reaching a one-month low against a basket of currencies. This is a potentially adverse scenario for the bond market, says Madison Investments Mike Sanders. This dynamic of rising yields alongside a falling dollar could become a longer-term threat to the bond market, particularly if global investors begin to reassess their exposure to U.S. assets, the head of fixed income said. The DXY dollar index falls 0.3% to 98.805, having earlier hit a low of 98.694. Treasury yields rose last week, with the 30-year Treasury yield hitting an 18-month high of 5.161%, according to Tradeweb. U.S. bond markets are closed on Monday. Four books sound the alarm about the power of private equity. Private managers now influence the U.S. economy and politics in the ways few Americans understand, by Matt Wirtz. Private fund managers are using April's market mayhem as a political tool in their campaigns to pry open a vast new market, your retirement account. Firms such as Apollo Global Management and Blackstone are arguing in Washington that when turmoil strikes public markets, Americans would be better off investing in their private equity and private credit funds. They contend that the funds provide ballast because their assets rarely trade, so their valuations are more stable during downturns. Critics say that their firms are turning to the retail market because they have tapped out big pension funds, and that private markets are a bad fit for individual savers. Smooth valuations can mask big problems, and private market funds can prevent clients from getting their money out in stressed markets, they say. What are everyday savers to make of this debate and the firms at the center of it? A clutch of new books can help explain how the so-called alternative investment industry has taken over Wall Street and increasingly influences the U.S. economy. Alternative investment companies already deploy money for pension systems and the uber-wealthy in private equity, private credit, infrastructure, hedge fund, and technology ventures capital. They control more than $15 trillion in assets, according to Preqin, and are quickly supplanting banks as the preferred source of capital for millions of consumers and tens of thousands of companies. Still, the average American is only vaguely aware of them. The more people don't know and don't care and think it's too esoteric, the more time goes by and the private equity industry is just getting richer. Carrie Sun, a former personal assistant to Tiger Global Management co-founder Chase Coleman, said in an interview. Sun describes her overtime on the job in private equity. The memoir and Hedged Out, a High Finance Ethnography by Megan Tobias Neely explains the new financial order by dissecting the people who run the investment firms. Other books, Sachin Kajaria's 2 and 20 and Brendan Bellew's Plunder, do the same by analyzing the companies and the deals they make. Private or alternative fund managers now bankroll virtually every piece of the U.S. economy and make lots of money doing it. They collected an estimated $252 billion in fees in 2023 globally, about six times the $41 billion they made in 2013, according to Preqin, a firm that sells data on private funds and that was recently acquired for $3.2 billion. Fund managers far outnumber tech moguls and bankers on the most recent Forbes list of millionaires, of billionaires. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon sits below about 40 private equity executives on the list. Chieftains like Apollo's Mark Rowan and Blackstone's Steve Schwarzman also wield increasing political clout. Donald Trump consulted Rowan on the economy and picked hedge fund manager Scott Bessent for Treasury Secretary, a post typically held by bankers. Fund managers recently deposed top U.S. university leaders and crushed government efforts to regulate their businesses. I've never seen so many billionaires, Stephen Meyer, chief investment officer for New York City's pension system, said on the sidelines of a private equity conference in Midtown Manhattan. These are smart, hardworking people who've been in the right place at the right time, and I have to ask a fiduciary, maybe we're paying too much in fees. That question is crucial because alternative investments are now being sold to regular Americans through funds and their 401k savings plans. Private equity fees cost clients about 6 percentage points of investment returns, while stock and bond exchange-traded funds charge almost nothing. And that's all we have time for today. This brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.